Welcome to Editing Loud, where South Africa's top journalists dissect the news events of the week and provide fascinating insight into what this all means. So welcome, panel. Perhaps let's start at the state capture inquiry, which has been fascinating this week. I mean, the banks have been testifying, and there have been tons of revelations. I mean, Jana, how do you sense the banks, how do you think they did? I mean, I think it's contributed a lot towards this discussion, but how do you see it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think especially Standard Bank's testimony on Monday, you know, it certainly linked the ANC and some of its top leaders directly, you know, to the mess. And people like Wery Mantashe, who's, you know, they've always denied, oh, the state capture thing is just a fiction of the media's imagination or whatever. And I think it's very clear that they had no qualms trying to do the Gupta spitting for them as well. And I think also hats off to the banks who didn't go and meet Letuli House to be bullied into keeping accounts.
Which banks didn't? I mean,
it was Absa and FNB, if I'm correct. I don't know. Yes. So it's Nedbank and Standard Bank that went to meet with them.
Ray, one of the things I found fascinating about Standard Bank's testimony is that the ANC had essentially called them to meet them in Letuli House. Gwede Mantashe, Jesse Duarte, and I think it was Enoch Godongwana as well. And basically they were told that, you know, did you close the Gupta's accounts because you got a call from Stellenbosch? Are you representing the voice of white monopoly capital in doing this? What does this say about the kind of people who are in the top leadership of the ANC that they say this stuff?
Well, it's just curious. I mean, it shows that there is no idea at all about how the private sector works, or shareholdings, or whatever. Because, of course, Stellenbosch doesn't control or hold a stake of any substance in Standard Bank. And as a very excellent column in the Financial Mail points out, you know, the PIC is the big shareholder, which is government-controlled. I think it's a sort of bully pulpit idea of what the party should be doing. You know, they did a similar thing with the judiciary when they called a meeting with Mogoeng and the other judges to try and sort of educate them on how they should be, you know, doing their jobs.
Yeah.
This idea that you've got to go to Letuli House and get a hammering if you're off point, it's just naive and silly, you know, because we're in a very regulated and legally, constrained environment for corporates, and they have to operate according to the law.
Sikonathi, do you think that the ANC should be summoning private companies like they did with the banks to the Letuli House to discuss decisions like that? I mean, it seems odd at the outset to be asked to do that.
Obviously, it's not just said, it's highly irregular and inappropriate. And I'm quite surprised Standard Bank and Nedbank did agree to go. Yes, they may have refused to discuss specific clients, but what business did they have to go discuss banking with the African National Congress? And this, again, exposes the ANC for what it really is. All of a sudden, the main players in the ANC, Enoch Godongwana, calls Nedbank, calls Standard Bank, Gwede Mantashe, all of them. And they then pretend it was just Jacob Zuma alone and his government that was doing this.
So, I mean, Ray, another thing I found fascinating was the interministerial committee set up by Mosabenzi Zwani, who was, let's remember, the mining minister, not the banks minister. He basically misled Nedbank into believing that Pravin Gordhan was going to be at the meeting when he wasn't.
Yeah.
But what I found really fascinating is that he threatened the banks. He said that, you know, you get your licenses because of us. So if you don't open the Gupta's accounts or are amenable to listening to us, then we could revoke those licenses. I mean, that is a staggering threat, surely.
Well, it's an understanding of how society works, is that you have power and then you dispense patronage and people fall into line. This is how it works. And if they're out of line, you call them into your office and you give them a talking to and you explain to them. And actually it doesn't work like that, and it cannot work like that in a constitutional democracy. So it failed. You know, I think the important point here is that this meeting, you know, these meetings that were held did not produce the results that they wanted, because the regulatory and legal environment in which these banks operate, you know, just overwhelms the, you know, what a political party can do in its offices.
That's true, but equally, I mean, why should a political party not know? I mean, the person who's the mining minister to not know that this is completely irregular, to lean on companies like that. The thin line between corruption there must be incredibly thin.
But Rob, you are being too generous. He did know, and he was doing this deliberately, and even going as far as encouraging Standard Bank to break the law in order to carry on banking for the Guptas. So he did know. This was a total and blatant abuse of power, no less than the other abuse of power that was, in fact, carried out by the same guy who flew all the way to Switzerland to negotiate a mining deal for the very same family. He negotiates a change of ownership in a mine where, as a minister, he then has to sit and approve the change of control. The question is, do they do anything? Do they go even an inch out of their way as much as did, like they did for the Guptas, for the ordinary people that voted them into power?
Well, it certainly looks like the ANC's top brass was entirely obsessed with trying to get the Guptas' bank accounts open. I mean, some of the testimony, Jana, that I found fascinating was how the Guptas sent an instruction to Standard Bank to get hold of the mining rehabilitation funds. I mean, you're not allowed to do that, right?
Yes, unless you've got Mr. Benziswane as the Minister of Mineral Resources and he gives permission. I mean, and he did give permission, and that money went out of the country. So they did, I mean, they were allowed to release it and they got access to it, and it's probably in Dubai or somewhere more exotic by now. But I mean, and it's. I think the real question is also why was he allowed to get away with this? I mean, he was in that role for quite a long time, caused a lot of damage. And it's a department that's abused its powers in many ways. I mean, Section 54 safety stoppages issued at mines, and if somebody doesn't pay up, your mine just doesn't operate. And it's one of the things that Gwede is now trying to clean up in the department. He's closed the Limpopo office, that's since reopened, closed it in Mpumalanga. But this is the problems are also much deeper than just at ministerial level.
So, I mean, Ray, in terms of what this means for the ANC, obviously it exposes its economic illiteracy when it comes to shareholding and what Jana described. But, I mean, to some extent, we've got Zizi Kodwa, the spokesman, going out and saying the ANC is not on trial here. Surely the testimony of the banks the last couple of days puts the ANC firmly on trial.
Yeah, it does. You know, I think that you've got to distinguish between the hardcore Gupta rights ministers like Zwani, and then these politicians that just go with the wind. I mean, at the time when this happened, there wasn't a serious challenge to Jacob Zuma. It seemed that he would get his successor in place after he left. And so the Mantashes and the Gorongwanas and everyone, you know, were sort of just going with that. We'll just go along with the Zuma thing because it keeps us in, you know, in power within the party, and it offers us potential to get somewhere. You know, now that everything's changed, of course, they're on the other side of the fence now, you know, and mightily embarrassed, probably, that all of this has come up. And Mantashe has already been sort of issuing statements about what's been said at the commission, but it hasn't really volunteered to appear in person and be cross-examined.
Surely Moses Benziswane should appear. I mean, he has to account for this, like you said, outrageous abuse of power at some forum.
You're quite generous in calling them economically illiterate. I think they are thuggish. That thuggish behavior. Come here, all of you white monopoly capital bankers. Sit here. Open those accounts. We say so. Or we'll change the law. That's what it is. Now, Judge Zondo does have the powers to subpoena whoever refuses to go to the commission. And I don't think the Mantashes of this... I can expect Zwane to want to be subpoenaed, but I don't think Mantashe should wait until a subpoena. I do think that he will volunteer himself and grace the commission with his presence and tell the people of South Africa how much he actually does for any other business.
Yeah, compared to what he did for the Guptas.
Exactly.
So one other thing just before we break is that another thing Zondo did this week was part of the Constitutional Court judgment on Dacha that is now going to be legally grown, I'm sure, at Sekonati's farm, right? I mean, now that we can do that.
We've always grown the finest in Pondoland, right there on the coast. Now, I can tell you, but I can tell you now that my homeboys there, my neighbors, should be quite depressed with this ruling, for what it will do to prices of the plant.
I actually think it could be pretty devastating for the prices, because you know now that it's legal to grow your own in your yard, you know you don't need to get it from the Transkei anymore, do you?
But that's why the ruling, in a way, was a sort of a half measure, wasn't it, Jan? I mean, basically, it said you can use it, you know, in your home, but how do you get hold of it? I mean, it didn't really go towards commercializing it in the sense that it has done in some countries where you can actually build an industry of it.
Yes, and I think Zondo should have gone that far. I think he should have legalized it, made it, you know, that we can catch up. I mean, in Pondoland, we can maybe this is one of the things we can be internationally competitive at. So why don't we open it up? People are growing it anyway. Legalize it. Make it. Let us build industries. Let us build these businesses. I mean, you see in Canada, there's companies listing. I mean, $1 billion takeovers. That's where the rest of the world is going. We're doing it anyway, illegally, and it's used. You know, it's used to control people. You know, you've seen in Holobeni. Where the police, you know, the anti-mining activists, you know, they get raided all the time. The guys who are pro-mining, they can grow their dacha without any problem. So let's legalize it. Let's get this thing off the ground properly.
Legalize it. Ray, so in terms of this judgment, what I found fascinating as well was the way in which it swapped from the earlier Constitutional Court judgment that said you weren't allowed to do this. That focused on the potential harm and they had medical experts. But in this case, they compared it to alcohol, for example, and said, "What's the harm of this versus alcohol?" I mean, that's an interesting shift in terms of what it does for privacy rights. Do you think? I mean, what?
Yeah, I think the privacy thing seems to have been the main lever used in this judgment. And so, as long as it's for private use, as long as you're cultivating it for private use, storing it, possessing it for private use, and then using it in private, it's fine with Judge Zondo.
I think the Constitutional Court has just opened the thing. Remember, Parliament makes the law, and it has given Parliament, 18 months to actually make a proper law. It is Parliament that can then change the law properly and say, this thing is legal. I must tell you, on the 15th of July 2016, I wrote in the Financial Mail a column that asked, who is the victim of this apparently illegal drug? Who is the victim and how better? Or why is this worse than alcohol? Surely you can plant the damn thing and the Parliament should now get to that level where it will say, commercialize it.
Do you think that the Constitutional Court read your column and thought, well, we've got to change the law on this?
I shall not bring the Honourable Court into disrepute.
By assuming they read your column in the Financial Mail?
By assuming they take instructions from me.
Okay, guys, after the break, we're going to discuss the JSE and China and Naspers. Welcome back to Editing Loud. In recent months, there's been a lot of discussion about some of the subpar quality listings we've had on the JSE. We've had Oak Bay Resources, which, as we now know to be slightly less reputable than a Ponzi scheme. We've had AO. We've had a couple of others that were terrible. We had Steinhoff collapsing. So the JSE has been debating how to fix its systems in a way, do new things to make it to allow less unsalubrious companies to list. And so they issued a consultation paper this week to that effect. Jana, I don't know if you've read too much of it, but essentially there are some interesting ideas in that new paper, right, of how to fix it.
I've read your excellent thoughts on it, Rob. That's about how far I got. No, I think it's been a topic of big debate, and everyone on investment Twitter, I'm sure, have shared their views, especially since Steinhoff collapsed. It's really been a debate. Should there be more regulation? Where is the JSE? Why is the JSE so quiet on these things? You have companies going into business rescue, for example, Basil Reed, then the shares don't get suspended. Should it be suspended? So I think there's been a lot of, there has been a few things that's been irking investors. I suppose the other side of the story is nobody forced you to buy shares in Oak Bay Resources. So why not give investors the choice? I mean, ultimately, it's your decision to, you know, you can look at it and decide it's a dog and not put your money there. So I think that's the balance that they need to strike.
One of the things with Stanov, I think, is that the board is notoriously undiverse, if there is such a word as undiverse. But essentially, you had a bunch of older white guys who all thought the same, sitting around a table talking about how fantastically smart Marcus was. And they've isolated this as one of the problems, lack of independence on the board. I mean, so one of the things they propose, Ray, is a vote on diversity that will go towards the vote at the AGM, and then if more than 25% of shareholders say no, then they have to engage with the shareholders. Do you think that's the kind of thing that would encourage greater diversity on the boards? I mean, do you think that people actually care about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to have diversity. You've got to have, there's got to be disagreement and different perspectives and people with different interests and historical backgrounds. You know, it's essential. Otherwise, there's no check on, you know, it's like having all the holes in the filters in the same place. And when you put them all over each other, the water goes through. You've got to have people who can catch what's seeping through the first layer. So I think it's a very good suggestion, aside from the fact that we actually need it anyway.
Yeah, for sure.
As a society, we actually can't have this complete lack of diversity on major, major boards.
But, Sikonati, is the argument not that we have rules already and the rules haven't stopped these terrible things happening, that you can put in place more rules, but if no one's policing the rules, that's like what's happening in the rest of society. If no one's enforcing the rules we do have, why put in place more rules anyway?
That's exactly the point I was going to raise. Who is policing the rules we already have? So the JSE itself has been incredibly laid back about all of these things. They're only reactive, and even then, only when someone suspects there's some insider trading, the JSE says, we'll investigate. You never hear anything. A year later, they find someone, 10% of the profit on that apparently illegal trade. There's no active, the Financial Services Board, whatever they are called today, I have not a clue what they do, really, if all of this happens under their noses. The question about diversity and all the other things, it's fantastic. There should not even be a debate about it. But are the enforcement divisions of the JSE and the takeover regulation panels, the Financial Services Board and everything, are they doing what they are supposed to do? Or is this yet another exercise to settle management teams with red tape, where managers are being dragged away from their core business into ticking boxes and then go and vote and go home?
But I do think that one of the suggestions is that the large shareholders, like Coronation, who owns more than 5% say of a company, the fact that they will have to disclose, they will have to vote, which is currently they don't always do, and they'll have to disclose how they voted on the resolutions at an AGM. Mm. That's surely useful, Jan. I mean, surely that would add greater transparency to the market and let people know what these guys are thinking.
Yes, absolutely. I think it would be great for, you know, improving transparency and also, you know, giving Coronation clients the right to say, but hey, hang on, why did you vote in favor of this if it's so very clearly the wrong thing to do? I think my problem with non-binding votes is you see it with executive pay, which is a similar thing. If more than 25% of people vote against it, they have to engage. Yet the problem doesn't really go away. So it feels like it needs more teeth than just saying there's a non-binding vote and if your shareholders aren't happy, talk to them about it. You know, and a lot of these things just don't get enforced. You know, equal pay between men and women. For me, it's a bit, let's see what the final version is, but I'm not overly excited about what they're putting on the table.
The great part about this is now finally forcing the asset managers, your Alan Gray's Coron, your PIC, to account. Because all of the time, all of these things happen and their clients lose money. They say, we are talking behind closed doors. Now get out of, come to the front. Let's all see what you're getting up to. Account for these huge fees that you're getting. This is the only part that's been missing. All the institutions have really been doing next to nothing. As long as the share price is going in the right direction, they were happy. Yeah. At this point now, this allows them and actually does force them, if it is approved in that version, to account.
Mm. I do think the PIC has been getting much better in terms of disclosing how they vote.
So 3 months later.
Yes, I mean, but still, at least it does become public record.
But, I mean, these are still proposals, and I'm sure the asset managers will have some thoughts on that. I mean, Ray, I mean, I'm sure a lot of them wouldn't like to do this, right?
And
I mean,
again, we'll
they like to operate
behind closed doors.
Exactly. Yeah. They like to talk behind closed doors. But it's better for transparency in the market to hear that, you know, Coronation thinks this director's poor and doesn't want to vote for this guy, and it makes other people aware that, you know, perhaps this person shouldn't be on the board. I'm sure that's a good thing.
I think for investor confidence, you know, and for retail investors, I mean, who actually can't really do the sort of research that would uncover a Steinhoff coming down the line. If you're a small retail investor, and you, as they are now, or passive investors for that matter, so the responsibility is so much greater on those who actually have the resources and a big enough stake to actually do this work and play the part of major serious shareholders.
Yeah. To move on to something else, the JSE happened on the JSE this week. Naspers decided to unbundle multi-choice. Sekhanati, what does that mean? Is that important for people? Why did they do this?
You guys on this show have been arguing for this very thing to happen. And it has now happened.
Unlocking value, right?
Unlocking value. Great. It's great Naspers is doing it because these businesses, other than Tencent, have been valued by the market at zero. Basically, this is a 41 billion rand business. And if you look at a company like Aspen, for example, which is in the top 40, it's also been a 41 billion rand revenue. So Naspers is quite right in saying, we'll put this right at the top 40. But you have to ask, why now? In the financial mail, again, there's that fantastic column that says, you guys at Naspers, for the past few months, have been mooning like the metered taxi drivers in the face of Netflix. Technology has come to rescue. So the monopoly on pay TV is now gone, and it's never coming back. They realize that. They don't see too much growth on the African continent, where they already have 13.5 million households. It seems to me like this is a mature company now. They don't see too much growth, and the best way is to manage to not lose their time over it. Let the investors worry about that, and they will sit with Tencent, of course, and the other internet companies. And I guess indeed that is good that they are bringing a choice to the market, yet another technology company. And the even the fantastic part for me is the BEE element. So the shares. 20% of multi-choices shares are held by black people, and I'm one of them.
Through Putumanati, right?
Through Putumanati.
And those shares went up 44% or something ridiculous?
Went up 44%, exactly after a dividend of 20% of the price. Then it went up 40%, but it's going to be now unlocked. What's the term? There will be no restrictions on black investors at the time of the listing, which, again, should more than double the price. So it's a fantastic opportunity. And then they add the other 5%. Naspers will give to black investors an additional 5% of the business at no consideration. We won't have to pay for that. Doesn't it nice?
But Ray, I mean,
in South Africa.
Sounds too good to be true, doesn't it?
You're getting dinner, that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, multi-choice as a business, right? I mean, it's facing, like Sekhanati says, these things from, you know, these competitive pressures from Naspers, Showmax. I mean, would somebody buy into this thing would anyone buy into multi-choice given that you see that they charge a lot of money, there are fewer people in this country who can afford it with the recession and jobs being lost, and you have Netflix, you have Showmax. I mean, what is the kind of future for pay TV?
Showmax is theirs, by the way.
Yes, that is true.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, they've just priced themselves out the market. That's what that's the problem with multi-choice, is that now that there are competitors, people can actually assess the price. Whereas before, it was multi-choice or SABC.
Well, have SuperSport. That's a really good asset.
Yeah. So, now people have suddenly woken up to the fact that actually 900 and something rand a month is a lot of money for television entertainment, because you can get very excellent global products for one-tenth of the price. Mm. And I think that's their problem that they have to grapple with. So, you know, I think it might be a good time for you to take whatever's on the table and then sell.
And then buy us dinner.
No, I'm not going to make that recommendation. But I don't, again, you know, maybe it's time for a wave of innovation. You know, South Africans can be very innovative and very creative. And maybe something new needs to be born here that actually can challenge Netflix and these other things.
But like what though? Netflix is already an innovation product in itself. It's a new thing that's come out and it's done really well.
Yeah, but I think that, you know, allowing Netflix to come into South Africa and buy a whole lot of South African content, which is what it's doing, without going in there and fighting for that and saying, okay, this is, you know, we're going to own this market. We're going to outbid you on any, you know, whatever you're prepared to pay for this domestic South African content, we're going to own it and we're going to be the platform for that. Rather than just sitting back and letting it go because we don't pay for local content unless we're really, really, you know, and then we pay the bare minimum.
Yeah.
Something like that might be the model, being able to produce a domestic offering that's very compelling.
Jan, I mean, Naspers' share price has been struggling recently, and part of it is because of what's happening in China, with Donald Trump hitting them with new trade tariffs. I think Jack Ma, the Alibaba founder, he talked of a potential of a 20-year trade war. What are Naspers' prospects in that context?
Yeah, I think they've had interesting challenges there it's a highly regulated market as well, with the Chinese government not licensing some of Tencent's games and kind of strange things, because the government have always seemed to be very supportive of the technology sector there and, you know, giving them a lot of protection against competition like Facebook, for example. I suppose from Trump's perspective, there are reasons why, valid reasons for countries to be annoyed with China and the way that they do business and the way they've built the economy. For example, cheap state loans to industry, making it very hard for the likes of US companies to compete in many ways. You know, not a lot of intellectual property protection, for example. But I think, you know, perhaps Trump also needed Europe and Japan and some other powerhouses on his side when he started this fight with China. And it doesn't help if you're at the same time also fighting Europe and Japan and Mexico and Canada and all your major partners. So I don't think there's going to be a quick resolution to it, and I think it can get much uglier than it is at the moment. But who knows what he's thinking?
What Trump is thinking, that's an assumption that there is actually thought processes going on.
Yeah, well, you know, and the thing is the U.S. Imports a lot more Chinese goods, significantly more than what they export to China. So when it comes to trading, you know, a trade war or just on exports and imports of goods, you know, this can go on a long time before China, before the U.S. will be bullied into backing off. So
okay, guys,
well,
that's a wrap for us for this week. And join us next week for more fascinating thoughts. And Jana will tell us if the trade war worked or not. Thanks a lot.